It's September the 28th, 1977. My name is James Murphy, and I'm talking with Major General George Kitching, who commanded the 4th Armored Division during the Normandy campaign. Well, General Kitching, I believe we made a mistake about the name of the
Yes,
village.
Jim, I would like to correct one thing that was on the last tape. I mentioned that I felt the name of the village that we waited for within 4th Armored Div to be secured before we broke through was a little village called Saintho, but it wasn't. I've checked on my notes and on the maps. It's a little, an even smaller village called Gomenil, but it was also held by 12th SS Panzer Division. But Gomenil was the key to our movement, and I just wanted to correct that.
So how efficient was the communication between various elements in the division during the operation?
I think normally we had first-class sets, because if we adopted a British set, we generally changed it to suit Canadian patterns. After all, the Canadian Signal Corps probably was certainly the largest. I think it was the largest, even larger than the infantry, if I remember, before the war, and had had the regular Canadian Signal Corps had service in the Arctic, which no other government department, no other agency had had. And so the officers and NCOs of the Royal Canadian Corps of Signals, I think when we started in 39-40, were brilliant in their adaptation of communications to environment. I think we were extremely fortunate that we had these people, because initially the British produced a whole series of sets which I think from your knowledge, from all our knowledge of the operations at Arnhem in 1944, September 44, 4 years after the war, these British sets were absolutely useless. They broke down, which would never have been permitted had they been Canadian sets. I think I don't know why the British allowed this to happen, but they did. When Canadians got British sets, we either didn't adopt them, or we changed them so that they were suitable, in our opinion, for operations. And this meant not only the makeup of the set, but the way in which it was carried, the way it was mounted, the percussion of the movement of vehicles and so on, and the impact. So I think generally, certainly within 4th Canadian Armored Division, we had good communication, which would have been. But a set relies entirely on the operator, you know, and the conditions in which he's operating. And although we'd done everything we possibly could to guarantee good communication, there were occasions, such as the destruction of 4th Canadian Armored Brigade on, I think it was the 14th of August, when the whole brigade headquarters is destroyed, in other words, all communication ceased, and you wonder why. At that critical moment, for instance, we were being bombed by our own Air Force. I say we, that's the tactical headquarters I had from 4th Armored Div. And I had, I guess, about six or eight tanks and about as many vehicles. And we were holed up on a ridge overlooking the battle. We could see the battle going on when, unfortunately, we were bombed. Mostly by our own Canadian Air Force at the time. They dumped about 700 tons of bombs in our vicinity. And although not one of us in the headquarters was injured, except, you know, by blast and so on, but nobody was hurt or wounded physically, the communications were destroyed, because you when you start dumping 1,000-pound bombs and 5,000-pound bombs within 200 yards of a tank, you're inclined to put the thing out of kilter. So in these emergencies, all communication ceased, or very often it ceased, for a while until you could get re-established. But generally, I think we had good communication. I think some of them were cumbersome and had to be carried in jeeps. I think I've forgotten the number of the set, 26, I think. I've forgotten now, but far too big a set. And things like walkie-talkies, don't forget, have never been heard of. The first walkie-talkie I saw was in the summer of 45. Now, had we had those, we would have been a lot better off within units, battalion, company, and platoon. Right.
What about between the corps headquarters and...
Well, of course, you know, they were great vast machines, those tremendous things with aerials in all directions. And generally, they were good. They were good communications. We had superb operators. I think, as I mentioned earlier, I think all the personnel of the Canadian Corps of Signals were of the highest caliber. I don't think... I think in many cases they were the saving grace. And if a set wasn't as good as it should be, they made it. They could operate, and by God, they did. They were good at cipher. They were good at... you can tell I have a high opinion of the Corps of Signals. But when you say communication, you mean did I communicate or did we communicate? No, you mean the physical.
Well, perhaps on a... One could also mean it on another level, if you had a request of your brigade commanders, or the other way, if the corps had a request of you, could this be relayed efficiently and that sort of thing? And was it in fact?
I must confess, I don't think I talked very much to Corps Headquarters myself. I think the GSO-1 did. He talked to Headquarters, I think, and kept them informed as to what we were doing. And certainly John Proctor, who was head of administration, was in very close touch with Corps. I think at the main headquarters there was a good contact. If I could say one thing without being really disparaging, I don't know whether senior staff officers at Corps are supposed to go down and see what's happening at a divisional level or not. Certainly, in First Corps, when I was chief of staff, I would say we used to go down. But certainly in Normandy, I didn't see anybody at my headquarters. From the Corps Headquarters level, except, of course, General Simmons. But I think this may have been because of the tremendous urgency, the demand of the operations, which were pretty goddamn hectic. As I mentioned earlier, the place is like a nut house, you know, with a vehicle or a man about every 10 yards for several hundred square miles, as it were, of Normandy. And with orders changing and... With situations changing at the speed they did. And I think Corps Headquarters had to work pretty hard, because Guy Simmons worked them hard. He made them produce very rapidly the orders for the major attack on the 8th of August, Total Eyes. Then we had a 3 or 4 day fight period after that, when I think another division took over from us in the area of Brettville, Larrabe, whatever it was, and tried to attack the Quesnay Wood. I think it was 3rd Division, if I remember. And then suddenly the Corps Headquarters had to produce a plan for Tractable, which was the next major operation. And it was a huge operation, one that demanded great detail in the way of fire plan, both air, ground, and movement of people on the ground, the artillery as well as the air. So I think probably the people at Corps Headquarters that one might have expected to see, you just didn't see because they were so goddamn busy trying to do what Guy Simmons had them lined up to do. I think this is the problem. more than any willingness on their part to go forward, but I don't know.
How about the German tank? Was it, in your opinion, superior to the Canadian?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt that the big tanks, the Panther and the Tiger, were superior in hitting power. After all, I think the Tiger had an 88 in it, which is a very hard-hitting gun. And although we produced for Normandy the 17-pounder gun, as we called it, which was really an anti-tank weapon with shells that could penetrate anything that was opposing us, I think it's fair to say that the 76-millimeter cannon that we had on the Sherman was not a match for the big guns of the Panther and the Tiger. On the other hand, as it was proved in Italy, if you're fighting in fairly enclosed country, orchards, villages and so on, it isn't always an advantage to have a very big gun, because every time you want to rotate, you almost have to back away from a tree before you can swing around it. Mm-hmm. And as the Three Rivers Regiment proved at Termoli in Italy, when they destroyed a fair number of German tanks, the short-barreled cannon that we had an advantage under those conditions. The other thing, I think, was that the big German tank, I think, I may be corrected on this, but I think when they rotated, a lot of it was by hand rotation, that is, of the turret. In other words, this tremendous cannon could only go at a certain speed, whereas ours was mechanical. You press a tit and the thing swung, and could swing quickly. I know the Poles, General Maciek of the Polish Armored Division, told me that one of his regiments was made up of a small British tank called a Cromwell, which was a quite good tank, but it had great speed. And he told me that at one time, when the Germans that he was confronting had the long barrel and Panther and the 88 of the Tiger, that in fact they could make speed faster at probably 700 yards distance from the Tiger than he could turn his turret. So that it's almost rather like a little destroyer going past and firing 4-inch cannon at an enemy ship, which has to keep rotating its 16-inch guns rather slowly. So that Maciek said his fast little Cromwells could, they were, I think, called a reconnaissance tank. I forget what the armament was. It wasn't, may have been a 6-pounder gun only. But he said they, in fact, could get off about 4 shells to every one that the Germans are firing at them. But there is no doubt, I think it's shown in almost every battle in which the Germans fought up to, including Normandy, that the 88-millimeter cannon, the gun that Rommel used, first of all, as an anti-tank weapon as opposed to an anti-aircraft, was the killer. It killed us. There's no doubt. It killed in North Africa, where as soon as he got there, and he would deploy them in such a way that they almost invite you in. And then when you're into the box, they would open up, and they had when they hit, they hit. You were out. They just brewed up every tank, one after another. So when the Germans hit, and they had far fewer tanks than we had, I would say that they had a much greater impact than hit of ours. I don't think we hit them. It took two or three from us to knock them out, generally.
But the Canadian tank had generally superior mobility and...
Well, don't forget, it was the old Sherman. It was an American tank. The General Worthington had developed a Canadian tank called a Ram tank. And Worthy knew a lot about the principles of armor and its use and its development. And I think a part of the Ram tank, the Canadian, became a part of the Sherman, which became the Allied tank. Everybody adopted it. We all had it. And it was a good workhorse, about a 30-ton job. And it had enough armor that normally you had a fair chance of success. But on the other hand, when you hit one of the big German tanks, or if you hit an 88, it got you. It was a good, I think it was the best workhorse. It was the kind of thing that we needed. It was rather the equivalent to me of the Jeep, the Duck, you know, the overwater vehicle, the Sherman tank, the Dakota aircraft. They were war winners in the sense that they were mass-produced, and the Liberty ship. You know, how many did they build, the Americans? I forgot, thousands of the damn things, each of 10,000 tons. These were war winners. So they may not be quite as good as the Germans, but the numbers that came off the production line were so great that they had to overcome.
They could afford not to be good.
Yes, yes, not to be that good, anyway. Right.
Did you feel that the Canadian armor, was used properly during the Normandy campaign?
You know, Jim, this is it's difficult. How can you use armor when you're boxed in? When you're, as Guy Simmons admitted in his story, to put two armored divisions through a little gap, such as he did, really was not sound. But he said he decided on it because the idea of putting one through and then another one through it again might well lead to delays. As I think I mentioned on the last tape, I think an armored division normally should have some freedom of action, not to take part in the breakout battle, but it should be so close to the follow-up, to the success of the initial break-in, that it sort of goes through like a dose of salt. Now, in the case of 4th Armored, no. We sat around, I remember, from about 7 in the morning. We were supposed to go through this little village, Gomenil, at 2 o'clock, which was the time when the bomb line lifted. But at 2, it was still being attacked by somebody else, by the 2nd Division, I think. So all this time, you find this vast amount of armor backed up. I think I didn't see enough, really, of the battles in which infantry and armor. I think the landing in Normandy on June the 6th, 7th, 8th showed the best use of armor as we would know it in the Canadian Army. I think we then, the 3rd Division, 3rd Canadian Division, had an objective. It had good training. It had the forces available to do the job. And it had enough room to maneuver. And they did damn well. As I think I mentioned, 3rd Canadian Division achieved its objectives when nobody else did on D-Day except the British Airborne. We were far ahead of everybody else around us. And I think that on the battalion and regimental level, that is the battalion of infantry, regiment of artillery, regiment of guns, I don't think anybody could beat us. But when you start putting brigades, when you put bigger formations in, I think you've got to have more room than we had to have. Somewhere around, whenever the heck it was, about the 13th of August, I remember Guy Simmons got everybody into his headquarters, and he distressed me, and I told him afterwards that I was a little bit hurt by his remarks, because he said that the number of casualties in the infantry was so great compared to the number of casualties in the armored regiments that he rather suspected the armored regiments were not trying hard enough. They weren't fighting hard enough. And I think this is a very unkind remark of Guy's. Certainly my own two brigadiers came to me right after his remarks and said, "Christ, I hope that doesn't apply to me." And all I could say to them was, well, we haven't been in it enough, really, to make it apply. But apparently Guy Simmons felt very strongly that the 2nd Canadian Armoured Brigade, which had supported his infantry divisions, had not put in enough wham, enough elan, or whatever you like to call it, enough professionalism to take the shock in the way the infantry had. I don't know. It's awful hard to tell. It certainly, that talk of his did not improve the morale of the armored regiments, I can assure you. I know. They were mad. I don't think for a moment that what they then did, in other words, went out and rushed at the enemy, was due necessarily to what Guy Simmons remarks, but it, I felt it was unnecessary at the time, in the middle of the goddamnedest battle in history, to start berating one corps in front of another. I don't think it's a way to run a war. That was my view.
Quite so. So, to sum up, if I could, the armored mobility was not used.
Well, you couldn't
because
use
of the
it.
Crowding.
Don't
get, wasn't
you know,
used.
After the initial wallop into Normandy, when 3rd Division landed, they got in about 7-8 miles, I think. Now, don't forget that was in on June the 9th.
Sixth.
Yeah, 6th, but then by 7-8-9
right,
they had reached the peak. And I think, if you look at the map, it then went from June the 9th to August the 8th. We only went about 12 miles.
Right.
12 more miles.
Things would naturally get jammed up.
And sure they were. And in between was a great big city, Falaise, and a tremendous river at that point. So rivers are always a blockage from the point of view of armor. They're always a blockage. And unless you're going to produce either a crossing or a wading area or something that they can get across, you're going to canalize them. And as soon as you do that, it's just like any highway. You can put 50 vehicles at a bridge, and if only one can get across it, then you're going to end up with 50 vehicles in a line. So you slow everything down by that much. And unfortunately, the armor would rush at an obstacle. Say two squadrons, whatever it was, up, they would hit the obstacle and there would be one crossing, and then everybody would have to shimmy down and get in line almost to get through that crossing, so that the speed of movement was one tank, basically, in the end. You can have 60 up, but it's the speed of one tank as it crosses that one bridge or that one crossing that slows your whole momentum. Do you see what I mean, Jim?
Like a rush hour, sir.
It's like a rush hour when the cop stands there blowing his goddamn whistle, and you've got to conform because there's no other way to get across. And this happened in subsequent battles in Normandy. But if I could just add one thing, I think at the regimental level, I don't think our armored regiments were at all bad. I think that is within 4th Armored Div. I think. The problem really was the higher direction of that brigade, basically, during the period that I commanded in Normandy. And that was the big problem.
So, my next question was the initiative shown by the squad and regimental level. So, if there was a problem, it certainly wasn't there.
Well, I disagree. You know, Charles Stacey in his history says that. That he was of the opinion that it appeared. Now Charles is a good historian, so he doesn't present arguments unless there is some substantive reasoning behind them. But he felt, from his study of the figures and of the problems at the time, that the regimental officer in Canadian units was not as good, really, as the men deserved. I disagree with Charles on that. I think one or two commanding officers were not so good. But I think the young subaltern, the young captain, and the young... Everybody was young, don't forget. 21, 23, 25 were majors. You're commanding a unit at 28. So everybody was young. Maybe some commanding officers were not as good as they should have been, or they didn't show the initiative at the time. But My firm recollection of the regiments, the of infantry and armor, was that the young officer and the major were damn good. I think they may have been a little sticky, because after all we were all new to the business, but I don't think they were quite as bad as Charles pointed out, in my opinion. I think the problem may have been on the higher levels. Certainly in 4th Armored Div, I had a damn good start. I had a first-class brigadier commanding the infantry brigade, Jefferson, Jim Jefferson, who commanded the Loyal Eddies in Sicily and Italy. And he stayed with that brigade until almost the end of the war, within a month of the end, and was solid, firm, decisive, quiet. But people had confidence in his judgment, and he had a lot of guts. Jim Leslie Booth, who commanded the armored brigade, had done so well in Sicily and Italy that I honestly believe Leslie Booth knew he was going to be killed. When I saw him last, on the 8th of August, total eyes, and I got him out of his tank and gave him a rocket for not following up quickly in this Gomenil pocket, this place where you were supposed to break through. And I had a horrible feeling then that Boothy, he was in almost a state of shock. I had to go and find him, which annoyed me no end, I remember at the time, wandering around the battlefield looking for a goddamn brigadier with a pennant up to indicate, you know, that he was where he was. And I remember my aide and I looking all over the place for him, and vehicles every 100 feet almost, and then the thing. And we finally came to him, and I think Boothy realized, I don't know why, but when I saw him and got him out of his tank and talked to him, and I went back to mine and said to my aide that I thought Boothy was either unwell or just didn't feel he would last. And this is a man who had been so full of courage, you know, 6 months, 4 months before. He was killed a few days later. And I just feel in my own heart that Boothy knew his ticket was due, and I don't know why. It may have slowed him up. I don't know. But however, you can't destroy a headquarters, and the whole headquarters was destroyed, and expected to be reborn in the point of view of taking command again. So I think we let down the units in that respect. In other words, higher headquarters. We didn't produce another command organization for them. And I think it's reflected in most of the stories that have come out, that they went ahead and they crossed during Operation Tractable, when Boothy was killed. They crossed the Laysan River, I think, and they tried to do their best. And then suddenly, of course, they had no orders. Of course there were no orders. Nobody knew Boothy had been killed. I didn't know, for Christ's sake. And nobody knew. So for about 6 hours, there's absolute, not bedlam, because the fellows are doing their jobs, you know, as they were told to do their jobs. But eventually, having achieved their objectives, they looked for Joe behind them to tell them what to do next. And there was no Joe. And nobody knew what had happened to him. Nobody knew he'd been killed. I don't think we knew until about six or seven or eight that evening that he was dead, that headquarters had disappeared. We couldn't get them on the blower, but that doesn't mean to say that, you know, that they were all finished. So I think certainly within 4th Armored Div, I think the armored regiments did damn well, considering the fact that they had almost an absence of control. And as I mentioned, I think, on the tape last week, Boothy having been killed, I then appointed Colonel White of the Governor General's Foot Guards to command the brigade. He was the next in line. He had his foot blown off, about 4 hours later. So then it devolved, and you can imagine the chaos of change and counter-change. Mm-hmm. That means he is taken away from a regiment, which means the regiment then has to take a squadron commander out and put him to command the regiment, which means a shuffle within the squadron. It has quite an impact. And then when White was wounded, Bill Halpeny, who was the last commanding officer I had left in the armored brigade, because Don Worthington had been killed about 4 days before, 3 days before, Bill Halpeny went, and he took over the brigade. But it's bloody hard to step out of his environment. He never expected to command a brigade, and I think you've got him mentally ready and alert to do it. Do you know what I mean? Oh, you can't, for Christ's sake, if somebody said to you, suddenly go out and take over a beat of a cop, you really wouldn't know what the hell to do unless you thought about it.
Right.
And we demanded a great deal of Halpeny and others. And that meant somebody else had to take over his regiment. And this was really the only quarrel I had with Simmons in Normandy, was the long delay from the time Boothie was killed to the time that I got Monsell, who was to command the armed brigade, because Guy Simmons and I had an arrangement which we had made long before the battle took place. In fact, the day I got to Normandy, and I think also in England we discussed it, if anything happened to different people, who would I have to replace them? And certainly in the case of Booth, I said if he's killed, I would take Monsell. I knew Bob well. And as I mentioned, and Charles Stacey mentions in the history, there was a period of 5 days, five very critical days, when Monsell was sitting on his backside somewhere in Normandy, doing nothing. He was a colonel then. He was a staff officer of some kind, but he could have been spared. And when I finally was fired from 4th Div, I told Guy Simmons that I could never understand why I didn't get Monsell immediately. Christ, he was a 2 hours' drive away. And even if he'd been on a temporary basis, you know, it could have got the momentum going. However, bloody hard, you know, when you're looking back 20-odd years, or 30 years, my God, it's over 30. Or is it 45, 70 years?
33 or so.
Yeah. But I remember that was the only thing that I felt very strongly about, was the fact that command, or the control, is so essential. And if you don't get somebody to replace you, your casualties, then the control disappears. And in that case, I think in that respect, we did let down the regiments within the armored brigade. Yes, I think so.
I see. What about the effectiveness of the German anti-tank weapons such as the 88? And
well, I think I mentioned earlier, Jim, there, when you fell into their trap, you fell into it good and hard. And I don't know of any. I think Guy Simmons' plan for the Operation Tractable, which followed Total Eyes, of this tremendous smoke barrage, smoke screen, as it were, was a wonderful one. But unfortunately, as you probably know in the story, one of the liaison officers from, I think it was 2nd Division, was captured the day before. And on him was a complete plan of the operation. So the Germans were immediately alerted, everybody was alerted, that there would be an attack at 2 o'clock or whatever the hell time it was, at 12 o'clock, I think, noon. And it would be preceded by immense smoke. So the Kurt Meyer, who had 12th SS, who was opposing us, moved a battery of 88s up to deal with us. And those guns had a great range for those days. I mean, they could knock you off Sherman at a mile, which is a worthwhile target, you know. And a mile is a long way. It's not a long way to see a tank, but it's a hell of a long way to find a gun in a wood or sticking out of a wood. And although it may fire, and the trouble with the 88, it had such a high velocity that you really didn't hear it. It hit you, and then you heard the on the way. You know, the crack thump was so instantaneous. As opposed to many others that go have a a nice lobbing effect, and you can hear them coming and rolling over as they come towards you, and you drop on the ground. An 88 hit you first, and then you heard it coming. So it was very difficult for tank commanders, if they were hit by an 88, really to know where the hell it came from, because the percussion on their own tank, if it was not killed, knocked out, would be so great that frankly they'd be wondering whether they were going to brew up or blow up or, you know, and they wouldn't be looking too much for what hit them. Maybe a neighboring tank would, and would be able to engage, but I think, well, everybody knows the Rommel technique with these damn things, and when he was around, they certainly operated in a way that was a classical example of the anti-tank screen. Mind you, we had some good anti-tank weapons. We had a 17-pounder that did tremendous damage in Normandy when it could find a target, but the problem was to find a target. We were never defending. When you can defend, you can bury yourself, all except the snozzle, you know, and the gun, and do great execution. But we were always attacking. We were always the guys out in the open. This is the big problem. But the few times that that our 17-pounder, which had a tremendous shell on it that could penetrate almost anything, I think, what, 10, 11 inches of armor, when it hit, when they could find a target, it did great destruction. And it had a very low silhouette, so you could put it in a hedge and it would be lower than the almost the bottom of the hedge, whereas the 88 had a very high silhouette. It was really an anti-aircraft gun that had been put onto the ground targets, onto tanks, on the anti-tank row. So it had a very high silhouette, very difficult to conceal, unless you went behind a ridge, as it were, and had enough of them so that anything that came over the ridge was immediately hit. Then you... It wasn't a case of observation, because they couldn't see you. Nobody could get in the position to see you. You see what I mean?
Right.
But our little 17-pounder, a little, Christ, they had a barrel about 12 feet long. I mean, it was a very hard-hitting weapon if you could find a target, and that was a big problem.
Were there any... were mines used? Anti-tank mines?
In Normandy... I think there were, of course, a great many in the initial invasion area, but subsequently, there were not... I remember we were still worrying about them all through the period I was there in late July and August. Everywhere you went, whenever you went across country, you always assumed that somewhere there would be a minefield. But I think that, frankly, by the time, by August... The enemy had so few people available to lay mines, their communications to bring the mines forward had been so fractured, so destroyed, that I don't think there were a hell of a lot. There may have been a few, the kind of mine that that you could lay very quickly, just throw across a road or across a trail, but to dig them in and produce a fearsome minefield, no. They did have a funny little thing called a Goliath that I remember seeing one. It was a tank about 8 feet, 9 feet long. Didn't have anything in it. And it was manipulated by indirect control. It was about 3 feet high, 9 feet long, and inside it was nothing but high explosive. And this miserable little thing crawled across the country at you on tracks, designed to really to frighten you, to scare you to death, and of course they did, because they were then detonated by the fellow at the other end, mm-hmm. at the point of that he felt was worthwhile. They used them in Normandy at one time, not in an anti-tank role, but in a scaring kind of a role. Because the infantry were dug in, and there's nothing more awful, I would imagine. I didn't see them at that close quarters. I was watching them through the steeple of a little church. But if you're an infantryman and you've just dug yourself a nice little hole about 3 feet deep, and you're squirming at the bottom of it, and you see one of these goddamn things coming at you out of the corn and the wheat and the maize and whatever the hell's growing, and you wonder if the fellow who controls it has seen you enough to, you know, to press the tip when it's anywhere near you. Our people tried to destroy them, of course, by tank fire. And they did. They hit a few. But they didn't do any great damage, but I do recall very, very, very vividly the story about these damn things. I went down to see Brigadier Booth, who had the armed brigade at the time, and we clambered into a church and went up in a spire, and we could see these. There was just one coming up the upper slope at the time. It was more a terror weapon than a... It wasn't terribly effective. I think whoever invented it was probably given the Iron Cross, I don't know.
What about the your terror weapon, the phony tank? We mentioned it last time, but would there whose idea was it, for example?
Well, initially it was mine. You know that we had a 3-day period when we were doing nothing, and in order to occupy my mind, and we were talking about it, I suppose some of the people at the headquarters. And I just felt that if one could... We were trying to hold the Germans on that, as I mentioned last the last discussion, to hold the German SS forces and panzer forces on the front of the Canadian and British armies in order to keep them away from the American side. And I remember saying, well, let's produce a monstrous goddamn horror that'll hold them, because they might think we've got 50 or 100 of these damn things somewhere. And that with these you could, I mean, had that been a real tank, nothing could have hit it, nothing could have destroyed it. Its dimensions were monstrous. And so that's how it was cooked up, and within about 3 hours I did this silly little doodle on a piece of paper, and in came the engineer and the commander of a Remy company, electrical and mechanical engineers. And between them, they went off, and that's how Phony was born. And I'm sorry that we weren't able to show it more to the enemy, because it was just a piece of sheer baloney, really. But it might have had an impact, had they had a week to look at it, and had it been able to move from one place to another, so that it appeared to be almost if we had several of these monsters, because... Believe you me, when you have a telephone pole, you're talking about at least a 9 or a 12-inch gun. In other words, something that wouldn't just kill a Tiger tank. It would knock it up in the air. It would sink it like a submarine. Mm-hmm. I mean, it would just
blow
right off the highway. I mean, nobody would ever be seen again in it.
What was it made out of?
Well, it was based, of course, on the old Sherman.
Right.
The Sherman tank was inside it all. But it was made of tin. No, it was made of metal. The outside was all metal. The gun was wood. The turret and all the flanking armor was of, I would think, quarter-inch metal that somebody had dug out from some... Near Caen was a place called Colombelle, which had been a tremendous iron foundry. And I think they went there and they picked up sheets of this damn stuff and stuck it on. But in order that... don't forget, since the inside of it, the top, was so empty that there was in fact no mechanism in it, that very wisely the man who then carried the design further hung in it hundreds of sandbags, empty, hundreds of them, so that if a shell went through, there wouldn't be a hole. Because obviously, do you see what I mean? If an anti-tank shell hit and went in one side and out the other, and there was nothing, there was just a great big gap in the middle.
So it made it...
It was just like a tin shell.
Made it difficult to see through.
Indeed, you couldn't see through it, because the idea was that all these sacks, and there were literally thousands of sandbags hanging in this thing, no matter which way a shell went in and went out, the sandbags more or less fell back into place again, so that it wouldn't be too obvious that it was a phony. So there was a... When you think of it, it took about 2 days to produce it. I talked to guys, told Guy Simmons about it. He wasn't terribly interested. He was interested, but not... he just said, George, I've got more things to think about, which he had at the time. He was then cooking up Operation Total Eyes, and he had all the problems that went with it, and so he wasn't my great supporter in this at all.
How would you duplicate the tracks on that?
Well, they were phony, of course. They were absolutely... They didn't turn. They just were large metal overlapping plates. We didn't feel it was really necessary for the enemy to be able to see the track turning. The track was made up of probably tracks of tin plate about 3 feet across each track. It was huge. And they were just nailed one out to the other or stuck on, as it were, by somebody. And they didn't rotate. The real track was inside the whole thing, pushing it along. I don't think the whole of all this new armor and tin plate weighed more than about 10 tons on it. You know, I think the barrel, this great big pole, telephone hydropole, probably weighed as much as all the tin and the metal that we hung around it as well. But
rather interesting. Didn't get into Stacy.
No, I don't think Charles knew about it at the time. You know, we kind of forgot about it fairly quickly. My recollection of it, just going along, was seeing it was so, the gun was so high that the ordinary pole, the poles on the French highway, in order to get the tank under the wires that were still there, mind you, they were not the old French wires, they had been destroyed. These were Canadian signals, you know, that had put the wires in over the top. We had to have a fellow sitting right on the end of the gun, on the end of this telephone pole, and he had a pole himself. And as he approached the wires, he pushed them over the top of the gun. So you're talking about sort of 30 feet mm-hmm. at the end of the cannon. So you can imagine the overall, I've forgotten, I would think it was about 50 feet long, 40 to 50 feet long, and about 25 feet wide. It was a monstrous tank in itself, however.
Well, we're pretty well out.
At the end of our tape?
Into the reel here.